Okay, so I'll refer to him as Bante. Bante means teacher, and so it's what many of his disciples call him. So Bante was born in 1925, August 26th, in Streatham in London, and he was brought up in Tooting. He was born as Dennis Lingwood. And he just drops in this little interesting fact, maybe interesting fact, that he was born just a very few miles away from where a Buddhist called Anandamattiya died 2 years earlier. And he just kind of muses, he's got no way of knowing, but he just kind of muses, is there some kind of karmic connection? Is there some rebirth thing going on there? Because he is such an unlikely person, and he is such an unlikely person to have arisen out of the context he was born into, which was working class family in South London. His father was a French polisher, his mother was housewife, as they were called in those days. And they're a decent pair of parents, but there was nothing very special going on there. And Anandamattiya is a very interesting character. He was the first Englishman to return to the UK, ordained as a Buddhist, ordained in the from the Eastern tradition. And I read his biography, and it's a very interesting biography, Anandamattiya. There's a lot of correspondences, but anyway, we'll just have to leave it there. So we catch more or less the only sight of an ordinary young boy up until about sort of 5 or 6. So on the left there we have Bante as a young boy, 5 years old, and somewhat later on as a late teen, I'd guess, with his mother and his sister Joan on the right there. So his sister is his only sibling. So what to say about Bante's early childhood? Fairly normal, as far as we can tell, up until the time when he was found to have a very high heart rate. He had valvular fever, and the doctor discovered that he had this worrying heart, and the doctor said he's got to have complete bed rest. I used to like doing that in these days. He's got to have complete immobility. He mustn't get excited under any circumstances. And so he was confined to bed. Even his sister wasn't allowed to go in and see him in case that got him too excited. Now, I think for many a child that would have been a rather dreadful occurrence. For young Dennis, what happened was he became this completely voracious reader. He discovered the world of books. In fact, he'd already discovered the world of books before. Soon after he learned to read, he worked his way through the book of Genesis, which was not an interesting first material to work on. Anyway, can we have reading number one, please?
Like the baby cuckoo, which keeps its sparrow foster parents flying to and fro all day with food for its insatiable maw, I gave my parents no respite from the search for reading matter. Having nothing to do except read, the rapidity with which I could devour a book became quite alarming. I must have held the world record for a boy of my age. Fortunately, the problem was solved by the next door neighbour, who gave me a complete set in 61 parts of Harmsworth's Children's Encyclopedia. This was a sizeable morsel, even for a digestion like mine. And it kept me fairly quiet for the remainder of the 2 years.
And he said he read every page of those 61 volumes, many of them many times. And it was from that early grounding, so this is sort of age 6 or no, I think this is age 8 at the moment. It's that early grounding in which he discovered a tremendous love, especially of art and literature. it was really taken by a lot of the legends, a lot of the more mythological material, and history as well. Anyway, so there he is. He's reading his way through these 61 volumes, and his father takes a second opinion. 2 years later, takes a second opinion from a different doctor, and the doctor says, "Rubbish, get him out of bed and get him walking." By which time he's forgotten to learn how to walk, poor fellow. So that's what happens. He eventually sort of relearns how to walk and fits back into school again, quite slowly. And let's just hear from reading two.
"When the days of my incarceration came to an end, my attention naturally was again directed to the outer world, from which I had so long been cut off. But this time it was not directed to that world more or less exclusively, as previously had been the case. The world of ideas and the imagination was now no less real to me than was the world of sights and sounds. My 2 years in bed had brought about a permanent change in my character, outlook and interests, a change that may not otherwise have taken place, at least not so early in my life. Henceforth, I was to live in two worlds, one I shared with others, one that was all my own. Inasmuch as they possess reflexive consciousness, all human beings live in two worlds, but whereas most people lived much more in the outer world of sights and sounds than in the inner world of ideas and imagination, with me it was the precise opposite. With me, moreover, the imbalance between my two worlds was far greater than it generally is in the case of those who are labelled introverts, and so remained so for some time."
Yeah, so I think this is quite a significant feature of Bhante, this very rich inner world, and especially his whole understanding of the importance of the imagination, and how the imagination is a critical faculty in the spiritual life. So the stretch up until he went to bed, so to speak, from age 4 to age 8, that was the longest period of continuous education he had. He is an autodidact, you could say. And even when he went back to school, he very quickly went to the top of the class and wasn't really that interested, because he just outstripped the other kids in everything except sciences and maths, which he wasn't really very interested in. So he just carried on reading with the most extraordinary voraciousness, you could say. And I think we can't really understand Sangrachita without understanding the place of the book in his life, in his imagination. If you read any of his autobiographies, they read a bit like a book list. They can get a bit dull at times. This one's been edited, much to his disgust, so the later ones haven't been. So you can have list upon list of different books that he read, which is tremendously significant for him. It's like he's saying, this is who I am, this is what informs me. And for most of us, they just go straight over our head. But in fact, many an order member have, in the olden days anyway, have followed a similar process of self-education by following the thread of some of Sangrachita's book reading. He's not just a sort of precocious reader. He wasn't just a precocious reader. He's got the most extraordinary recollection, and he can recall the content of books that he read in this period of time. It's not just sort of losing yourself in the book. He is completely immersed in the book when he's reading it. And not just that, he talks about being tremendously empathic with the author. So at the time as he's reading, he's engaging, he enters the world of the author very fully. And then afterwards, he enters into a more sort of critical mode, as he describes it. So he's got these sort of two facets, very, very empathic and critical, that he holds together in an interesting balance. Okay, so age 12, he discovers Milton and Paradise Lost. And he discovers this complete passion for poetry, which has stayed with him for the rest of his life. And he starts writing poetry at this age. And in fact, he advises us to read his poetry, not because he thinks it's great, but because it's a more personal way of getting to know him. So there is a book of poems that you can get your hands on too. Okay, let's now have reading number 3.
It must have been about this time too that I became aware that I was physically and emotionally attracted to members of my own sex. That I was attracted to older boys and to young men in this way did not make me feel guilty, nor did I feel guilt when the attraction started to assume a definitely sexual character, as it did a year or two later. It was a feeling that had arisen in me quite naturally. It was part of me, and I did not question its rightness. At the same time, I instinctively knew, even at that early age, that it was something of which society disapproved, and that I should not talk about it to anyone. Since I could not talk about my feeling to anyone, it was several years before I discovered that there were others who were attracted to members of their own sex, and that there was a name for this attraction.
I think this is rather unusual. If you bear in mind, this is in the 1930s, and here's a man who, or a boy, who seems to have worked out for himself the difference between what he later called natural morality and conventional morality. So he knew that this was conventionally immoral, but completely blameless, but the fact that he had what we now call homosexual feelings. So for a young man in the 1930s, I find that an extraordinary level of individuality, which I think in all sorts of different ways we discover later on in his life as well. Okay, so the war breaks out, and in 1940 he's evacuated to the southwest and into Devon. And I'll give you one little snippet. So he's in Barnstaple at one stage, and each week he'd walk to Biddeford, which is about 3 hours each way, to visit a second-hand bookshop. he walked so he had more money to spend on the books. And at this stage he found a book called Isis Unveiled, which is a work of the Theosophical movement. It's a sort of rather mystical text. And at this stage, reading this, he realised that he was not a Christian. He'd been brought up fairly conventionally as a Christian. He was in the boys' brigade, where you were drilled into good Christian morals. He went to Sunday school, but Isis unveiled the fact he was not a Christian. He didn't know what he was, but he was quite happy with that fact. So that takes us to his late teens. He moved back to London in 1941. He was homesick. And he worked at the LCC, the London County Council. County Council, was it? London County Council. He left school as soon as he could do, basically, and started working at the LCC. And this he describes as a tumultuous period. This is now his sort of late adolescence. And he describes this tumultuous period, a chaos of conflicting emotions. He describes listening to Bach's Toccata and Fugue and being annihilated by the music. He describes having a ruthless passion for the arts and a ravenous appetite for books. He also describes being a real pain to his mother and his sister. He would just brook no interruption. If you wanted to listen to some classical music on the radio, he would not let anyone get in his way. And he sounded quite a lot of shame around that. It's also a phase when he had various psychical and mystical experiences. So can we have reading number 4, please?
As I crossed from one side of the street to the other, I suddenly awoke to the complete absurdity of the mind being tied down to a single physical body. Why could I not look at the world through the eyes of the man standing on the opposite pavement? Why could I not know his thoughts as easily as I knew my own? As these questions flashed upon me, I felt my consciousness desperately struggling to free itself from the body and project itself into all the bodies walking around. Though its efforts were unavailing and it sank back exhausted, I thereafter had a feeling of being imprisoned. When years later I read in the Suragama Sutra, a famous text of Buddhist idealism, the dialogue in which the Buddha makes his disciple Ananda realise step by step that his consciousness is neither inside the body nor outside it, nor yet somewhere between, being in its true nature universal, I felt I was treading on familiar ground.
Yeah, so he had various mystical experiences which became a bit of a touchstone for him as time went by. Then there he is working at the LCC with earning proper money so he can buy even more books. And he comes across a pair of... He starts reading Eastern books as well as Western literature, and he comes across the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Wei Lan. So if we can have reading number 5, please.
If, when I read Isis Unveiled, I knew that I was not Christian, when I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew that I was Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes a teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arhats, saints who have attained individual nirvana, are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realised it ages before, and the readings of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Once I realised that I was a Buddhist, it seemed that I had always been one, that it was the most natural thing in the world to be, and that I had never been anything else. My experience of the Sutra of Wei Lan, which I read in the original Shanghai edition of Wong Yu Lam's translation, though taking place at a slightly lower level, was repeated with much greater frequency. Whenever I read the text, I would be thrown into a kind of ecstasy. The realisation that I was a Buddhist came in the latter summer of early autumn of 1942.
It's kind of easy to sort of miss the significance of this, really. If you were to look at the Diamond Sutra, it's a confusing text. It's very paradoxical. It's a big riddle, really. And for a 16-year-old, I think he was 16 at that time, to read it with immediate recognition is a bit kind of weird, to be honest. I can't quite get my head around that, but anyway, this is what he says. It just immediately spoke to him. And I think it's a really significant moment. That's the sort of watershed, really, from which the rest of his life flows. So at this point, I've skipped over a little bit, but I'll just say it briefly. He fell in love with this young woman called Sonia. He saw Sonia in the LCC secretly reading a book called Egotism in German Philosophy. And he said her conquest of him was complete at that point. Anyway, there's an unconsummated love affair there. He discovers the Buddhist Society in London, probably one of the world's first Buddhist societies, and he subscribes to the Middle Way for its little magazine, and he contributed 3 papers to it as a teen. The first of his papers, which I think is more or less the same time, he might have been 17, might have been 16 or 17, the first of his papers was called The Unity of Buddhism, which is, again, pretty kind of amazing. In the 1940s, to have a sense of the unity of Buddhism, when all he had in Britain was, you had the Buddhist Society, which was mainly Zen-based, and there's a little bit of Theravadan tradition there too. But he had already read so widely all sorts of obscure texts, and he had managed to intuit the transcendental unity of them all. This is pretty kind of strange, I think. And later on he met Christmas Humphreys, who is the chairman of the Buddhist Society, who was very keen to meet this very eminent scholar who had written this paper on the unity of Buddhism, and discovered a pimply youth. And it was in 1944 in Buddha Day in the Buddhist Society that he took the refuges and precepts for the first time from a Burmese monk. Okay, and then he promptly gets conscripted into the war. This is 1944. He's turned 18. He had a good war. I think we could say he had a good war. His home got destroyed by a V1 bomb, a direct hit. Luckily, no one was home. He gets conscripted into the Signals Corps, which he hates, but he's extremely good at Morse because of his tremendous powers of concentration. And he gets posted to India, which chuffs him no end. So he gets to the land of the Buddha. So here's, we can just see it up here, Delhi, right in the north of India. Not very strict military discipline. He hates whatever discipline there is. And he very quickly starts reading Buddhist books out there. He gets hold of Buddhist books and starts practicing them. He starts doing the mindfulness of breathing, sitting under his mosquito net, for example. And he makes contact with various religions, well, largely with Hindu teachers out there. There's very little in the way of Buddhism happening. And he goes and finds this, in particular, the Ramakrishna mission. He has very friendly connections with the Ramakrishna mission throughout his whole time in India. So can we have reading six, please?
Among the books I bought in Connaught Circus was a treatise by the great non-dualist Hindu philosopher Shankara. In it was described a method of meditation by dissociating oneself successively from the body, the mind and the empirical ego. At night, seated cross-legged inside the mosquito curtain while the other inmates of the room slept, I practiced according to the instructions given in the book. I am not the body, I am not the mind, I reflected. I am the non-dual reality, the Brahman. I am the absolute existence, knowledge, and bliss. As I practiced, body consciousness faded away and my whole being was permeated by a great, peaceful joy. One night there appeared before me, as if it were suspended in midair, the head of an old man. He had a grey stubble on scalp and chin, and his yellowish face was deeply lined and wrinkled, as though by the sins and vices of a lifetime. "You're wasting your time," he exclaimed with a dreadful sneer. "There's nothing in the universe but matter, nothing but matter." "There is something higher than matter," I promptly retorted. "I know it because I'm experiencing it now." Whereupon the apparition vanished.
So you find a very open-minded fellow here. He's deeply Buddhist, but here he's trying out these Hindu practices. And in fact, he met that apparition later on. We might hear about that next week. He visited many temples, Buddhist temples, well, various sort of temples, Buddhist temples, but also Hindu ones. And he was rather disappointed to discover all of his Buddhist contacts were all a bit lifeless, the temples were all a bit lifeless. So he decides to move down to Ceylon. He manages to get himself a transfer. As I say, he had quite a good war, really. So he thinks he'd be there better off in the homeland of Theravada Buddhism. There again, he makes very good contact with the Ramakrishna mission. Doesn't get on so well with the Buddhists, and starts pranayama. Again, he's reading a book about pranayama, this breathing method, which has a very strong effect on him, very strong disintegrating effect on him. He seems to be extremely sensitive to the practices that he undertakes. And there he meets one Swami in particular from the Ramakrishna mission who makes a very big impact on him. Can we have number 7, please?
Swami Pavitrananda was tall and thin and almost grotesquely bony. His eyes burned darkly in their hollow sockets. When he spoke, it was in a low, intense voice that was almost a whisper and with impressive earnestness. The two other Swamis emanated a mild glow of spirituality, but he was a consuming fire, like a moth by a flame. I was immediately attracted. In me, he at once took a great interest, and we had many conversations. Unlike the other Swamis, he did not speak about philosophy or literature or music, but only of the spiritual life. The need for simplicity, purity, humility, and devotion were his sole topics. He spoke often of the necessity for renunciation and of the happiness of a monk's life, compared with which worldly happiness was as dross. As I listened, my heart burned within me. Whether he asked me if I wanted to be a monk or whether I asked him if he thought it was possible for me to obtain monastic life, I do not remember. But from that time onwards, I was resolved upon a life of renunciation.
Right. Yeah, another significant moment, I think. And significantly coming from a Hindu Swami, but he's getting this real taste of the possibility of a living spiritual life. It's not just ideas in the book now. He's imbibing from the Swamis in the Ramakrishna mission. Basically a Sangha. He met his first Sangha in the Ramakrishna mission, and a sense of spirituality lived out in the present day. And they suggest that he visits the HQ, which is in Calcutta. So again, he puts in for a transfer, because our British Army give it to him. And he heads off into Calcutta in Bengal, out here. Where he also, his excuse is compassionately, he's got an uncle, Uncle Dick, who lives in Calcutta. And again, he falls in with the Ramakrishna mission. But also, there's the headquarters of the Buddhist Mahabodhi Society in Calcutta, who have quite a significant place in his life for quite a while. He doesn't like them very much. They're largely Hindu Brahmins, for starters, and not very much in the way of living Buddhism going on there, it seems, just a few lazy monks. So it's extraordinary. He has this rather poor impression of Buddhism in India, but still, at core, he's a Buddhist. But he hangs out with the people who inspire him, who are largely Hindus. Anyway, he gets posted off to Singapore just after the end of the war, which was a bit of a disappointment to him. Hooks up with the Ramakrishna mission in Singapore, learns Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, from a bhikkhu. He met a bhikkhu as well. And one significant person he met there is a Brahmin, young Brahmin man called Banerjee. They become fast friends. So here's Banerjee, and this is Banti and Banerjee. This is after they've become wanderers. And they decide to do something together. They're not quite sure what, but Banerjee's just off on his way back to Calcutta, and Banti says, "Okay, I'll see you when I'm demobbed." The demobbing doesn't happen in any big hurry. He's just sort of left there doing nothing very much in Singapore, so he decides to go AWOL. So he takes compassionate leave again to Calcutta and doesn't return. So he gets himself back to Calcutta again. And meets up with Banerjee, and then there's a bit of a back in Calcutta. And then Bansi finds himself, I won't give you the full story, but he finds himself right up here in Kaushali, right up in the north of India, in the hill station, in an ashram led by a woman called Anandamayi, who's this sort of, full of bliss, the name means, and she radiates bliss. And she gets on quite well with Bansi and vice versa. And Banerjee comes out and joins them, and they sort of hang out for a bit. And eventually they decide that organised religion is not going anywhere. There's just all this corruption. That they've been led astray by a fellow who'd been trying to sort of lead them on a little bit. So, another pivotal moment. They go forth. And they decide, this is it. We're going to be freelance wanderers in the old style. So they burn their identity papers. They get rid of all their possessions, except for a few, in Bansi's case, a whole bag of books. So they're wearing traditional robes, and they dye their robes in sort of earth, the traditional ochre colour, and they go forth. And they decide to go down to Ceylon, Sri Lanka, and get training in a proper Buddhist monastery. So they manage to get their way down there, they get on the ferry, they get to Colombo, and oops, they don't have any ID papers. And not only that, they refuse to tell the customs which country they're from. They're so principled, they refuse to say which country they're from. So they're turned back again. They could have got in if they'd have just told them. Anyway, they refuse to say. Being wandering holy men, they have left their identity behind. So they decide, okay, let's walk from here up to here. Let's walk to the Himalaya. Which is about 2,000 miles, and they reckon it would take them about a year. And by this stage, they're trying to meditate each morning. They'd gotten various meditation techniques from Anandamayi. They make it up to about Trivandrum here, and they discover that walking many miles in the heat and meditation do not mix very well. So they thought, okay, let's settle down somewhere, let's find somewhere to settle. So in Trivandrum they meet up again with the Ramakrishna mission and ask if they can stay, and they say, well, you can't stay here, but we've got this little place, this ashram in, how do you say that, Muvazapatza, which is empty. You can have that. You can hang out there. A really significant time. They spend over a year in this place. They basically establish a kind of an ashram and hang out with some of the locals around there. They collect money from the locals. They have all sorts of interesting, strange spiritual experiences there. And they establish a retreat lifestyle, basically. Bansi has this very regular routine of meditation, studying, writing. He's done quite a lot of writing by this stage. And also having to keep his friends. So he's still with this friend Banerjee. They've both changed their name by this stage. Bansi called himself Dharmapriya, and Banerjee was called Satyapriya. So Satyapriya turned out to be a rather fiery, volatile young man, and Bansi was in fear of his life at times. Banerjee did try to drown him at one stage. But the most extraordinary level of fidelity to Satyapriya. It didn't seem to cross his mind to leave or anything. He just put up with him. the two of them in this funny little ashram which is haunted. So one of you has got a reading which I don't think you'll read, where Bhante has this vision of hungry ghosts. Anyway, at some stage they read about this guy called Swami Ram Dass. They're both really fired up by Ram Dass, and they read this book that he wrote, which they're really turned on by, and then they discover he's still alive. So they go and visit him. So here's Ram Dass. Ram Dass is one of the most impressive swamis that Bhante meets. All the other Hindu teachers are very, they disappointed him with their adherence to the caste system. But Ram Dass completely rejects the caste system, which made a very big impact on Bhante. And also, Ram Dass offered to give Satyapriya and Dharmapriya a mantra. And they sort of say, okay. Thinking they get some Hindu mantra, and Ram Dass gives them both the Avalokiteshvara mantra. So it really takes into account where they're coming from. So that's his first mantra, the Avalokiteshvara mantra. So they hang about with Ram Dass for a little while, and then Ram Dass says, okay, time for you to move on. So Ram Dass is in Bangalore. He says, you should see Ramana Maharishi, who was one of the other great Indian teachers. I think he was the Beatles teacher, wasn't he? Was that right? Yeah. Anyway, so off they cut to see Ramana Maharishi. Again, very impressive character, still very strictly adhered to the caste system. And basically, he didn't give any teaching, he just gave darshan. Bhante was very sensitive to his darshan. He described it, again, I'm afraid we're not going to hear the reading, but it's like waves of peace flowing out from him. But by this stage, they're getting a bit, well, Bhante especially is getting a bit sort of fed up with the Hindu world. He wanted the Buddhist world. And he has a really important vision in this cave. So they were staying in the cave in this place called Tiruvannamalai. He has this vision of Amitabha, which is another pivotal point for Bhante, really. It's like this was saying, okay, it's time to get yourself ordained. We've had enough wandering around in the Hindu world, time to get ordained. So they decide to make their way up to Benares and Sarnath. So Sarnath is where the Buddha first taught, and they thought it's time to they knew that there's some Buddhist monks there, so they get themselves to Sarnath, and they were turned down. We're not having any mangy old wanderers round here, thank you very much. So they got a rather rude awakening there, got turned away, and then they decided not to be put off, they decided to walk to Kushinara, which is the Buddha's death place, where there's another temple. And they heard that there was a monk there who was a bit more generous. So they walked there in the middle of the hot season, through a curtain of fire, as he put it. Took them 12 days. Begging food, not handling any money, so they're doing it proper. And then eventually, Uttrandaramani, who's the most senior monk in India, he decides to ordain them. Provided they don't want any support. And that was his condition. Very nice fellow, apparently. So, Arathiria, here's Kusumara, right up in the foothills of India. I think this is his higher ordination a year later, actually. But anyway, here's Bhante holding a begging bowl. So at this stage, and only at this stage, does him and Satyapriya go their own separate ways. Satyapriya decides he wants to go to Sri Lanka. And Bhante has hooked up with this guy called Jagdish Kashyap, who is a monk who Bhante considers his first Buddhist teacher. And he was teaching at the Banaras University, Pali, Abhidhamma and Logic. And Bhante spent seven of his happiest months in Banaras, in Varanasi, studying with Jagdish Kashyap. And a really significant thing happened there. He rediscovered his love of poetry. And he had this huge conflict, this inner conflict between his inner ascetic, that he called Sangrajita One, and his poet, lover, which he called Sangrajita Two. And this conflict came to a real head, in which Sangrajita One burnt the poetry books of Sangrajita Two, burnt the books he'd written poetry in. And that led to some kind of crisis, which resolved in basically what we have now, which is Sangrajita's understanding of art as a really significant feature of the Buddhist spiritual life. We'll be hearing about that later on in this series. Anyway, after seven blissful months, Kashyap decides to go on pilgrimage around the Buddhist sites. And to cut a slightly long story short, where are we? So they go around these Buddhist sites. They go to Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha gained awakening. They go to Rajgir and Nalanda and Sarnath again, and Kusinara and Lumbini. And eventually, Kashyap decides he's had enough of teaching the university. He's going on retreat for a long time, and he takes Bhante off to Kalimpong, which is up in the foothills here, and he says, "You stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. The local Buddhists, they'll look after you." And he, Kashyap, heads off into the sunset. So there he is, Sangrajita. So he was ordained as Sangrajita. Sangrajita is now left on his own in Kalimpong. And that's where we'll leave him for a week until Ashwajit comes and tells us what happens. Okay, so I'll leave it there. There's maybe time for a couple of factual questions if anyone's got any confusions or what have you.
Were there many readings that we didn't have?
There were many readings we didn't have, I'm afraid. It was a bit of a gallop.
Yes,
I had a
question.
Sorry?
Did he speak Hindi?
Yes, I think he learned bits of Hindi. I'm not sure if it was very much. So I think when he was with Satyapriya, so Satyapriya is a Bengali, so he would have spoken Hindi. So I think Satyapriya did quite a lot of the talking. But at the same time, I think Sangrajita could get about a little bit. Certainly as time went on, he got about a bit more, yeah.
What does Sangrajita mean?
Ah, good question. It means protected by the Sangha, or protector of the Sangha. In fact, initially he was given the name Dharmarakshita. So when they're ordained, Satyapriya was called Buddha Rakshita, and Bhante was called Dharmarakshita. But then it turned out there was someone else called Dharmarakshita, so Sangrajita got called Sangrajita. So it was a rather strange kind of coincidence, really, that Sangrajita hadn't really experienced the Sangha, a Buddhist Sangha at this stage. He hadn't been taken in by anyone at this stage. He didn't experience a Buddhist Sangha for a long time. Not really until he formed the order, to be honest.
So he accepted the poet part of himself after he'd burnt the books.
That's right, that's right. He said it sort of shocked them both so much that they learned to live with each other. Yeah. So we've lost a chunk of his poetry from the time he left Britain to the time he left Singapore. Mm-hmm. All that not got burned. Yeah, it's worth checking up on some of his poetry. I mean, it's quite old-fashioned. Some of it I find really good, and most of it I find a bit too turgid to my liking, but I'm no poet, but you could have a look at it and see what you think.
Okay, should we leave it there then?